Okay, so have you ever heard of a case called West v. Prudential Securities? It's a really interesting one.
Oh yeah. That's a big one, especially for securities law. It kind of makes you think about like the limits of what we consider fraud in the stock market.
Right, exactly. It all starts with, like whispers, right? Imagine like a stockbroker who's telling a few select clients, "Hey, this company, it's about to be bought out. Big money coming your way." Sounds a little, well, shady, doesn't it? Like insider trading, maybe?
Yeah, for sure. But what if those whispers, what if they actually like messed with the entire stock market? That's what West v. Prudential is all about, and why it's such a big deal for lawyers and like anyone who's, into securities litigation.
Yeah, I mean, it makes you wonder, can a few private conversations really have that much power?
Well, that's the question, right? And it really forces us to look at this thing called the fraud on the market doctrine. It basically comes from this landmark case, Basic Inc. v.
Well,
Levinson.
basically, yeah.
Yeah, basically it says like if there's false information out there and the market's efficient, then anyone trading that stock can say they were, harmed, even if they never heard the lie directly.
Right. It's all about how information gets baked into the stock price, like it's assumed everyone's acting on it, even if they haven't actually seen it.
Exactly. But then West v. Prudential comes along and throws a wrench in things. Like, can this doctrine really apply to private statements? Like, what if it's just a few people in a room, not some big public announcement?
Right. It gets really tricky. So, okay, let's break down this West v. Prudential case. We've got this guy, James Hoffman, a broker at Prudential Securities. He's having these chats with 11 of his clients, but they're not just, talking about the weather.
No, not at all. This is serious stuff.
Right. He's telling them that this bank, Jefferson Savings Bancorp, it's a guaranteed acquisition target, like a done deal. Big payout coming their way if they buy the stock.
And this goes on for like 7 months, right?
7 months of these private conversations.
Wow, a long time. And here's the thing, it was all a lie. There was no deal. Hoffman was potentially, making stuff up, maybe even peddling insider information, which, as you know, is a huge no-no with the SEC.
Right, a huge no-no. So these investors, they bought Jefferson savings stock based on what Hoffman was telling them.
And naturally, they weren't too happy when they found out it was all, bogus.
Right. So they filed a class action lawsuit claiming that these private whispers, they still counted as securities fraud under this Rule 10b-5.
Which, it makes sense on the surface, right? They were misled, they lost money.
Yeah. And guess what? They actually won.
Yeah.
At first, anyway.
Right. The district court initially sided with them. They said, yeah, this looks like a classic fraud on the market situation. So they certified the class action. It seemed like a pretty clear victory for the plaintiffs at that point.
A big win, yeah. But Prudential Securities, they weren't going to just give up that easily.
Of course not. These cases, they're rarely that straightforward. And that's where it gets even more interesting, legally speaking, because Prudential, they appealed the decision and it went all the way up to the Seventh Circuit Court of
The
Appeals.
Seventh Circuit. So we're talking big leagues now.
Yeah, the big leagues. And this is where a very important judge, Judge Easterbrook, enters the picture. You might have heard of him. He's known for being pretty sharp, legally speaking.
Yeah, I heard that.
So the Seventh Circuit, they even issued what's called an interlocutory appeal. Now, that might sound like legal jargon, but basically they hit pause on the whole case just to address this one question about the fraud on the market doctrine and how far it can really go. And Judge Easterbrook, he wrote the opinion for the court. And let me tell you, he wasn't convinced, like at all. He even questioned whether, what these 11 clients did, even if they bought the stock based on Hoffman's lies, could that really manipulate the entire stock price of, Jefferson Savings for a whole 7 months?
That's a really good point. I mean, if the market is supposed to be so efficient, like everyone says, then wouldn't it like correct for that kind of thing?
Right. That's what Judge Easterbrook was getting at. He was like, okay, if the market's truly efficient, those whispers from Hoffman, they'd basically get drowned out by all the other information that's out there, right? The big investors, the institutional guys, they'd see what was happening, they'd jump in and correct any, distortions in the price.
So these arbitragers, right? The folks who are always looking for like those little mispricings in the market to make a quick buck.
Exactly. They'd be all over it. So, how could a few private conversations have that kind of lasting impact? That's what the Seventh Circuit was struggling with.
Okay, so did the Seventh Circuit ultimately overturn the class certification based on this idea that those private whispers couldn't have actually moved the market?
Well, yeah, they did overturn it. And their reasoning, it's really important because it set some, well, pretty big precedents in securities law. So we need to dive into that a bit more, but we'll save that for after the break.
Yeah, their reasoning was, well, kind of groundbreaking. Like, it really shifted things in securities law. It really did.
Okay, so break it down for me. What were these big precedents that the Seventh Circuit set with this West v. Prudential decision?
Well, like, first off, they made it super clear, you know, that public information and private information, they're two totally different things, right? Like, remember, basic, that case, it's all about information that's, like, out in the open, public. It gets factored into the stock price. Everyone's supposed to know about it, in theory, at least. But Hoffman's conversations with those clients, that was all behind closed doors, private. There's no guarantee that that kind of information would ever reach the, you know, the big players in the market, the institutions, the hedge funds, the guys who actually move the needle price-wise.
Right. So that's point number one, public versus private. What else? Well, the second big thing was, like, they demanded proof, real hard evidence. You know, lawyers, we love using those, what are they called? Event studies to, like, try to prove that there was fraud. But the plaintiffs in West v. Prudential, they couldn't show anything. Like, they didn't have any analysis that actually connected Hoffman's lies to, like, specific changes in Jefferson's stock price.
Oh, so it wasn't enough to just say, well, Hoffman lied and the stock price went down, so bam, there's your fraud.
Exactly. The Seventh Circuit, they were like, nope, not buying it. You got to show us the money, or, you know, the market impact in this case.
Makes sense. Okay. But didn't the district court initially rely on, like, expert testimony?
Yeah, they did. But Judge Easterbrook, he wasn't too impressed with that either. He was basically saying, look, courts can't just accept whatever experts say without, you know, really digging into it. We got to make sure they're using, like, solid methods, that they're actually connecting the dots between the alleged fraud and the price changes.
So he was raising the bar for what counts as, like, legit expert testimony in securities fraud cases.
Yeah. Big time. He was sending a message, you know, to lawyers. Don't come in here just yelling fraud on the market and expect to win automatically, especially if you're dealing with information that that wasn't actually public.
Like, he's saying, prove it.
Exactly. Prove it. And that that brings us to another really interesting aspect of this whole case.
Oh, what's that?
Well, it makes you think, how might this case, how might West v. Prudential affect cases involving other kinds of, you know, non-public information? Like, what about insider tips? Or those selective disclosures that companies sometimes give to, like, certain analysts.
Hmm, yeah. Those seem even trickier, right? Like, how do you prove anything if the information was never meant to be public in the first place?
Right, it gets really murky. And that's kind of the point. You know, West v. Prudential, it basically slammed the door shut on using fraud on the market as this easy way to win if the information wasn't truly public. So now plaintiffs' lawyers, they've got to be way more strategic. They got to focus on proving that, proving causation, maybe even on an individual basis, which can make those lawsuits way harder and, you know, way more expensive.
So is this a good thing or a bad thing? Like, is this a win for the defense, but maybe a setback for investors who might have legitimate claims but can't afford to go it alone?
It's complicated, to be honest. There are some legal experts who argue that West v. Prudential, it creates a much higher hurdle for plaintiffs, especially those smaller investors who, you know, who might be trying to get justice but just don't have the resources for individual litigation. But then others say, hey, this is a good thing. It prevents those frivolous lawsuits, the ones that are, you know, just clogging up the courts. It makes sure that that fraud on the market, this powerful doctrine, that it isn't abused.
So it's that classic legal debate, right? Balancing access to justice with making sure the courts aren't just flooded with, you know, baseless lawsuits.
Exactly. And it's a debate that, well, it's not going away anytime soon. Courts are going to keep wrestling with this as they, you know, as they deal with the fallout from West v. Prudential in the years to come.
Makes sense. So what stands out to you the most from this case? Like, what's the big takeaway for you?
For me, it's how complex this whole area of securities law really is. It's not just about, you know, catching the bad guys and punishing them. It's about navigating this, like, incredibly intricate system where things like market efficiency and causation and expert testimony, they're all tangled up together.
Yeah, it's a lot to wrap your head around. Mm-hmm. Definitely food for thought, you know, for lawyers, for law students, for anyone who's interested in this stuff.
Absolutely. And I think one of the most important lessons from Westview Prudential is that, you know, courts are looking at this fraud on the market doctrine with a much more critical eye now. They're not just going to automatically assume that every, you know, every public statement or, you know, non-public statement, as we saw in this case, that it like magically affects stock prices.
So they're demanding more evidence, more proof, raising the bar for what counts as a valid class action in these securities fraud cases.
Right. It's a reminder that that even those well-established legal doctrines, the ones we think are, you know, settled, they can still be challenged and they can be refined as new situations come up and courts have to, you know, they have to figure out how to apply those old doctrines to our, like, our modern financial world.
And speaking of Judge Easterbrook and, you know, his skepticism about applying fraud on the market in this particular case. I remember that that quote where he compares oral fraud to individualized whispers, right? That was pretty
cool. Yeah, that's a great analogy. It really drives the point home, you know? Like, without that widespread dissemination, proving reliance, which is like one of the key ingredients of securities fraud, it becomes a total nightmare. It's a logistical nightmare, right? Because each person's situation, it's unique, it's different, and that makes it really hard to certify a class action.
It's like you were saying, yeah, maybe those whispers influenced a few people, but they're not going to cause like a tsunami that wipes out the entire market.
Exactly. And without that tsunami, without that clear, you know, demonstrable market impact, the whole foundation of a class action, it just, it crumbles. So, okay, let's bring this all together. What are the big takeaways from our, you know, our deep dive into West v. Prudential? What are the things we should all remember?
Well, I think the biggest takeaway is, that the fraud on the market doctrine, it's a powerful tool. Don't get me wrong. It can be huge for investors, but it's not a guaranteed win. You need that strong causal link like we've been talking about. You need to show that the fraud actually caused the market impact. And you need expert testimony that can, you know, that can hold up under scrutiny.
Yeah, I agree with all that. And like we saw in Westview Prudential, courts are getting a lot more careful about how far they're willing to stretch this doctrine, especially when it comes to information that that wasn't really intended for the public eye.
So context is everything, right? This case shows us that that the law, it's always changing. It's got to keep up with the world around us, which is, you know, which is always evolving.
Yeah.
And even those legal principles that we think are like totally settled, they can still be challenged. They can be reinterpreted as new situations come up and courts have to deal with all the complexities of, you know, of modern finance.
Absolutely. That's a great way to put it. The law is always a work in progress, right? Always adapting.
Right. And Westview Prudential, it's a perfect example of that, you know, that evolution in action.
It really is. Yeah. And it kind of shows how important it is, you know, like to really stay on top of things in securities law, like to really get it. You can't just skim the headlines. You got to like dig into these cases, you know, and understand the reasoning behind them.
It's a good point, and I think Westview Prudential is a good example of a case that should make even, you know, experienced lawyers think twice. Like, you know, we got to be constantly reevaluating our assumptions, right? And changing our strategies because the case law, it's always evolving.
For sure. Yeah, what worked, you know, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, might not fly today. And for law students, you know, who are just starting out, this case, it's like required reading almost.
It's true. It's a great case study in, you know, in how to apply those legal doctrines to the real world. Mm-hmm. It shows how crucial it is to think critically and, you know, and really analyze the facts.
Exactly. And it also shows how legal principles and what's actually happening in the market, how those two things, they're always kind of pushing and pulling on each other.
Yeah, it's a fascinating dynamic. So what advice would you give to like a law student who's really trying to, you know, to grasp the significance of West v. Prudential? Like, how should they approach this case?
Well, I'd say don't just memorize the facts and the holding, you know. Go deeper, dig into the reasoning behind the Seventh Circuit's decision. Like, ask yourself, why did they draw such a hard line between public and private information? What were they so worried about when it came to, you know, to applying fraud on the market so broadly? How did they view the role of expert testimony in these cases? If you really wrestle with those questions, you'll get a much deeper understanding of the case and how it's shaped securities litigation.
Yeah, that's great advice. It's not just about the what, it's about the why.
Yeah, right? Exactly. And it's about connecting this case to like the bigger picture of securities law. How does West v. Prudential fit into, you know, our efforts to protect investors? What does it say about the efficient market hypothesis? How does it affect the balance between private private enforcement and, you know, government regulation. Asking those questions can help law students really get a, you know, a more sophisticated view of this whole area of law.
It sounds like Westview Prudential is like a gateway. You know, it leads to all these other really interesting questions about securities law and its role in, you know, in our financial system.
I like that analogy. Yeah. It's a case that makes us question our assumptions, you know, the evidence we use, the way we interpret the law, the consequences of those interpretations. Those are important questions for everyone, really, lawyers, law students, or just anyone who, you know, who wants to understand how financial markets actually work.
So as we wrap up our deep dive into Westview Prudential, what's the one thing you want our listeners to walk away with?
I'd say this case is a great reminder that securities law, it's always changing. New technology, new market practices, new legal interpretations are constantly reshaping the landscape. So we can't just sit back and, you know, and assume we know everything. Westview Prudential, it tells us to stay informed, to keep asking questions, and to be ready to adapt because things are always in flux.
That's a powerful message and a good reminder for all of us. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive into Westview Prudential. We hope you found it, you know, informative and maybe even a little thought-provoking.
My pleasure. It was great to be here.
And for our listeners, keep in mind, The world of law is full of these, you know, fascinating cases, these intriguing legal puzzles. So keep exploring, keep learning, and keep diving deep.